Did justice triumph? The Mutual Broadcasting System presents another actual criminal case history from the files of the Two Justice series, followed by millions of readers in the New York Sunday News and its syndicate. Tonight's case, the Unseen Murder Mystery. Crimes in modern fiction are usually solved by the masterminded super sleuthing of some imaginary private detective. But in real life, in actual criminal case histories, such as are dramatized on this program, criminals are generally brought to justice through the diligence and intelligence of hard-working police officers, doing their routine work day by day until the solution is reached. This fact is borne out again in tonight's real crime case, the Unseen Murder Mystery. The scene is Des Moines, Iowa, where a police squad car races up to the entrance of a swanky hotel.
This is it, men. Standish Arms Hotel.
Nice day for the murder, Inspector.
Yeah, it looks like this is going to be quite a whodunit.
Well, it all depends on what we find, Herman. Oh, come on. Better get inside the hotel and have a look at the body.
That hotel manager sounded mighty excited on the phone.
They're always excited when they have a killing.
Well, it's bad for business, bad publicity.
Go over to the desk. Find out what this is all about.
Yes, gentlemen.
I'm Inspector Curran from the Homicide Bureau. These are Detectives Waterbury and Herman. You the manager?
Yes, you got here quickly.
No time to lose in a case like this. Where's the body?
Room 218. We can go right up if you like.
Well, that's why we're here. Let's go.
Certainly. The elevator's right across the lobby.
You discovered the body just before you called us?
Yes, 10 a.m. exactly. The chambermaid was making her rounds.
This chambermaid is available for questioning?
Yes, she's waiting upstairs.
Floor, please.
Second floor, Jim. These are the police.
You have just the one elevator?
This one and one in back, which is the service elevator.
I want to talk with you later, operator.
Yes, sir. I'll be around.
Be sure that you are, Jim.
Yes, sir. Second floor, gentlemen.
Room 218 is just down the hall, if you'll follow me.
Is that the chambermaid who found the body?
Yes, Inspector. Oh, Annie.
Yes, Mr. Thompson.
These gentlemen are police officers.
Oh, detectives.
They'll probably want to ask you some questions.
Yes, sir.
You're the chambermaid on this floor?
Yes, sir. Yes, I am.
And I understand you found the body.
That's right, sir. I was making my regular 10 o'clock linen tour of the rooms. And I opened the door of 218 with my pass key. And there on the bed. Oh, I'll never forget that sight, never.
Did you see anyone in the hall?
No, sir, no one.
The room was empty except for the body.
Yes, it was horrible, sir.
We may want to ask you some additional questions later. You'll be around?
Yes, sir.
Good. Well, let's go in.
Nothing has been touched, Inspector. Everything is just as it was when the body was found.
Excellent.
Gosh, this place is certainly a shambles.
That's putting it mildly, Waterbury. The room looks as if it had been struck by a hurricane.
Somebody put up quite a struggle here.
And the somebody is doubtless that woman lying dead on the bed.
Bloody sight, isn't she?
Knife wounds. All over her throat and chest.
On her legs, too.
I'll have to wait for a complete medical examiner's report for details. But she certainly had a rough going over.
Inspector, I don't see any luggage.
Here's a woman's handbag.
Well, that's it.
It was lying on the dresser. Here you are.
Oh, thanks. Nothing much in it. Cosmetics, some cash. Let's see. $200.
That eliminates a robbery motive.
Yeah, that and the rings on her fingers.
Well, here's a social security card. Lily Grinnell, 5142 James Street, Des Moines. Waterbury.
Yes, sir?
Take this and check that address. Find out all you can about this Lily Grinnell.
Right.
Oh, there's a telegram here that may lead us somewhere. It's addressed to Lily Grinnell, 5142 James Street. It says, meet me, Hotel Standish Arms, Des Moines, 2:20 p.m. Saturday. Signed, John.
Which is probably the name of the man we've got to find.
Yeah. Mr. Thompson, under what name was this woman registered?
She wasn't registered.
Not registered?
No, a man registered for this room 2 days ago. He paid cash for 3 days in advance.
We'll have a look at the register when we go downstairs.
Certainly.
When did the man check in?
Late Saturday night, shortly after midnight. The night clerk was on duty then. He's a new man, but he remembers the incident very clearly.
Oh, why?
Mostly because 218 was the only available double room in the house.
Double room?
Mm-hmm.
Then this man checked in with someone else.
Oh, yes, another man.
Not this woman?
No, the woman arrived later. Last night.
Oh, I see she has a wedding ring.
What happened to the other man?
We don't know what happened to either of them. They just disappeared.
But how is that possible? Don't you keep a check on the goings and comings of your guests?
Usually, but when a guest arrives with no luggage and pays in advance, we have less reason for watching him. You see, we don't expect our guests to commit murder.
Naturally not. How about the man who registered? Can you give us a description?
I didn't see him, but I understand he was elderly, with gray hair, walked with a sort of a shuffle. The elevator boy can give you the details.
Uh-huh. You have a service entrance, of course.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, there's always a possibility that the man we're looking for went out that way. Hammond.
Yes, Inspector.
You'll wait here until the medical examiner arrives, then post a guard in this room and question the employees at the service entrance. Then meet me back at headquarters.
Yes, sir.
Waterbury, you'll talk to the hotel employees in the lobby, and particularly the elevator operator.
Right.
Well, there's nothing more to do here right now. Let's go downstairs and have a look at that register.
Here's the register, Inspector. Now, let's see. Saturday night.
You said after midnight. Wouldn't that be Sunday?
Oh, yes, you're right. And, oh, here we are. Sunday, June 29th, 12:25 a.m. John... Oh, I can't read that last name.
Let me see. Oh, neither can I. Looks like Stevens, or maybe Stevens' son. What a scrawl. Oh, I notice he skipped four lines in the register. Looks as if he might have been drunk. Was he?
The night clerk didn't think so, but he thought the man's companion had a few.
They went up together?
Yeah, then the companion, the other man, just vanished.
Well, I'm not much concerned about the other man, but I would like to find the man who signed this register. Mr. John Stevens, or Stevenson, or whatever his name is. You're positive you have no record of his checking out?
Positive?
Well, possibly one of my men may pick up something from one of your employees. I'm going back to headquarters and wait for their reports.
You were operating the elevator the night this man arrived?
Yes, sir.
Let me have the best description you can give of him.
Well, he was on the other side of 50, I'd say. Stocky, about 160 pounds. He had gray hair, and I remember he walked with a sort of a shuffle. He came in on Saturday night with this other guy.
And when did you next see him?
Well, last night, about 11:30.
Last night?
Yes.
What happened?
Well, he came down here to the lobby and then said he'd forgotten something and went back upstairs. And that's the last I saw of him.
Uh-huh. How did he look? Were his clothes mussed up?
No. He looked okay to me, but, well, he acted kind of funny.
In what way?
Well, his face was flushed, and he seemed sort of nervous. I remember he bumped up against the elevator door when he got in the car, but I thought he was kind of tight.
And you're sure you didn't see him again after you took him back upstairs?
Positive. I'm the only man on duty after midnight. He didn't come down in this elevator. Yeah, and if he'd come down the stairs, the night clerk would have seen him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's all for now. But we'll need you as an identification witness when we find him.
You're the pastry chef?
Yes, chef, but I don't want to get mixed up in this thing.
You're not mixed up in anything. This is a police investigation. We're trying to put a few facts together so they make sense. That's why I want you to tell me just what you saw last night.
Well, I was outside the rear entrance to get a breath of fresh air. Oh, the kitchen was awful hot.
Yes, go on.
Well, a little before midnight, I see a man leave the hotel by the service entrance.
Yeah, I'll be look.
He was a stocky, middle-aged. He's got the dark hair.
Dark hair?
Yeah.
You sure of that?
True, dark hair. I remember. He walked out the exit near the bakery.
A little before midnight.
Uh-huh. I followed because I think he might be a thief of some kind. Well, he got into bakery supply truck and drove off. I guess the driver must give a lift.
Ever seen him before?
No, I never seen before.
And you're sure he had dark hair?
Oh, sure, positive.
Well, thanks for the information. I'll be in touch with you again. In the meantime, don't tell anyone about our talk.
Later, at police headquarters, Inspector Curran and the two detectives sift the information they have obtained so far.
This case is a jigsaw puzzle if I ever saw one.
The evidence so far just doesn't add up, Inspector.
It's contradictory and confused.
That's putting it mildly, Herman. We've just sent out a teletype to all Iowa police asking for information on a middle-aged man with gray hair.
And now you come in here and tell me the man who went out the back way at the hotel has dark hair. We don't know who we're looking for. We're not even sure of his name.
I've got the medical examiner's report, Inspector.
Good. Well, let's hear what it says.
The victim died at about 11 o'clock last night. He'd been dead about 12 hours when we saw the body.
Uh-huh. That adds up. I don't suppose there's any doubt as to the cause of death.
None whatsoever. 14 severe stab wounds. The examiner says he thinks the murder weapon was a long knife with a narrow blade.
But I don't understand why 14 wounds and all over a body.
Possibly the attack occurred in the dark.
The report goes on to say that the wounds are sweeping incisions, not of too great depth. Apparently, the victim was slashed while she struggled, trying to get away. Let's see. Death probably instantaneous due to severed left ventricle. Oh, here's something of interest. Two of her fingernails were broken off, and there appears to be skin tissue under these nails. The lab is testing scrapings from the nails right now.
Waterbury, as I've been listening to that report, I've developed a new theory.
Yes, sir?
You recall I said a moment ago that maybe the attack occurred in the dark?
Yes.
Well, possibly it's something else. Let's analyze what we have so far. We have a body with 14 stab wounds all over it, found in a room that was a shambles.
Yes.
We have conflicting descriptions of an elderly or middle-aged man.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a woman's handbag containing some cosmetics, about $200 in cash, a social security card, and a telegram signed by a man named John.
Yeah.
Well, that's all. And to make matters more difficult, I found that the strip of tape at the top of the telegram indicating where the message was sent from is missing.
That's peculiar.
Yeah. Well, let's look at the contents of this handbag once more. Huh? What do you see?
Rouge, powder, lipstick, eyebrow pencil.
Yes, but look at this eyebrow pencil case. It's empty. The eyebrow pencil is gone.
I don't quite follow you, Inspector. What does that prove?
It doesn't prove anything, Waterbury. But it's an indication. An indication that the man we're looking for, the murderer of Lily Grinnell, is blind.
You're listening to a dramatization of an actual criminal case history of a strange and fantastic murder. The Unseen Murder Mystery, which resulted in one of the most remarkable examples of rapid and painstakingly smart police work in United States crime history. Justice was now on the trail of a blind man. At police headquarters in Des Moines, Inspector Curran continues his reasoning as to the murderer of Lily Grinnell.
Did you say blind, Inspector?
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah, but how is that possible? The man moved about freely.
And he had no seeing eye dog.
But don't forget that blind people often develop an acute sense of direction, as well as an ability to move about very well without the benefit of vision. I know it sounds incredible, but everything about this case is screwy.
Inspector, do you really think a blind man could have done this job?
Maybe it was two men. One with gray hair, one with dark hair.
Here's my reasoning. In the first place, everything about the scene of the murder indicates that the man was blind. The furniture all messed up, the knife slashes all over the body. They mean that the killer had to feel his way. And the woman kept putting things in his path, but he kept finding her and kept slashing wildly.
But why didn't she scream? We've had no report that there was...
Probably too scared. Besides, a scream from her would have helped him to find her in the room.
But, Inspector, how about his hair? That's one item that has me stumped.
Well, you recall the elevator operator's story, Herman? He said he took a man with gray hair down the elevator last night.
Yeah, he did.
Well, he noticed the man's face was red. So he was a little tight. Said he bumped into the elevator door.
Yes, well.
Well, then he said he took the man back upstairs. The man said he had forgotten something. And no one saw him again. At least they didn't see a man with gray hair.
But where does all this lead us, Inspector?
My hunch is that the man used the missing eyebrow pencil to darken his hair, and the rouge to redden his face, change his complexion.
So the man seen by the pastry chef out of the service entrance was the killer.
Exactly. Well, what do you men think?
Everything fits.
Well, it sounds logical to me.
Yeah. So far as ultimate solution is concerned, it merely means that we add the word blind to our teletype wanted message. Waterbury.
Yes, sir?
I want you to check immediately at the address on this social security card. Find out all you can about the habits and friends of Lily Grinnell.
Right.
Herman, take this telegram to Western Union. Find out where it was sent from, even though that's missing from the message.
Yes, sir.
And while you men are working on those two angles, I'm going to get out a nationwide teletype asking for any information concerning the suspect. I have a feeling he'll try to get out of the state. And therefore, we've got to work fast to get him before he goes into hiding.
Wanted by Des Moines Police Department, John Stevens or Stevenson, for questioning concerning murder of woman. Suspect in early 50s, approximately 160 pounds, has gray hair, sallow complexion, is blind. Please check all criminal records for information which might lead to apprehension of this man. Authority, Inspector Curran, Des Moines Police.
Yes? What is it?
You the landlady of this rooming house?
That's right.
Well, I'm a police officer.
What?
I'd like to ask you a few questions.
Well, certainly,
don't
but
get
I'm
excited,
not...
madam. This is a routine checkup on one of your guests. I believe you had a boarder by the name of Lily Grinnell.
Had is correct. She left here on Saturday. She didn't leave any forwarding address.
You wouldn't mind answering a few questions, would you?
Oh, no. I'd be glad to tell you whatever I can. Won't you step inside?
Thanks. I have just a few questions.
The sitting room's right here, the left.
Thank you.
Has anything happened? I mean...
All I want to know is what you can tell me about Miss Grinnell.
Yes. Well, I never knew if it was Miss or Mrs. You see, she got a telegram 2 days ago from a man asking her to meet him in a downtown hotel. I think he was her husband.
And why do you think so?
Well, one day he was here to see her. They sat right here in this sitting room. And I heard him tell her that he thought they were having a disappointing honeymoon.
What was the man like? Did you see him?
Only for a moment. He was about 50, with gray hair. I was surprised, because Lily was so much younger. She was a gay sort, and interested in parties, and kind of romantic.
Then she had other friends, other than this man you
mentioned? Oh, yes, she had many admirers. But somehow I got the idea she was married to this man. The last time he was here, he waited for her for several hours. She wasn't home.
Oh? Tell me about that. When was it?
Oh, it was the day she left. As I said, she'd had this telegram. And this man, that is the elderly man, he came in. And he waited and he waited. And finally she came in. And they had a sort of an argument. And he asked her why she hadn't met him at the hotel. And she seemed angry and she was anxious to get rid of him. So she told him she had a date. And she suggested that he register at the hotel, saying that she'd join him after a date.
And this was last Saturday?
Yes.
Thank you, madam.
Tell me, has something happened to Lily? Why are the police...
This is a serious case, and I must warn you not to mention to anyone that I've been here.
Oh?
Do you understand?
I wouldn't say a word, not a word to anyone.
While Detective Waterbury talks with the landlady of Lily Grinnell's rooming house, Inspector Curran and Detective Herman at police headquarters talk with the truck driver.
Sure, I drove that bakery supply truck away from the Standish Arms Hotel last night, but I don't know nothing about a murder.
Just tell us what you do know.
About what?
About the man you gave a lift to, the blind man.
I didn't know he was blind till after he got into my truck. I was about to start off, see, when this guy comes up to me and asks for a ride. I'm a nice guy, so I says, okay.
Tell us what happened.
Describe the man.
Sure, give me time. Well, like I said before to this detective here, the guy comes up and asks me for a ride.
When was this?
Oh, I'd say about midnight. Maybe a little before.
Go on.
Well, he gets into my truck, and I says, where to? And he says, the bus terminal.
Bus terminal?
Yeah, that's it. So I drops him there, and that's all.
Did you notice anything unusual about him?
Well, like I said, I found out he was blind after he got into my truck. And another thing.
Yes?
I noticed he kind of smelled of powder or maybe perfume.
The cosmetics.
What?
Never mind. Did this man carry a suitcase or a bundle of any kind as if he was going on a trip?
Yeah. He had a bundle of clothes wrapped up inside a dark suit coat.
How's he dressed?
Oh, I remember he wore some sort of heavy white shirt and some dirty overalls. They looked like they had paint on them.
And doubtless had his regular clothes packed up in the bundle.
I wouldn't know, mister.
Well, thanks very much for the information. That's all.
You mean I can go?
Yes. And don't mention this conversation to anyone.
Don't worry, I won't. I don't want to get mixed up in no murder.
Show this man out, Herman.
Yes, sir.
And check Western Union again about the origin of that telegram.
Yeah, sure thing. They promised me an answer about now.
Inspector Curran.
Inspector, this is Captain Manchester, Los Angeles Police.
Yes, Captain?
I have your countrywide teletype on that blind man you're looking for.
Yes?
I think I know who he is.
That's the best news I've heard all day. Let's have it.
Well, from the description you give, I'm practically sure that this man is a convicted murderer named John Stevenson.
Let me have all you've got, please.
Well, back in 1934, this man, John Stevenson, was convicted of killing a young woman in a cafe brawl here in Los Angeles. He stabbed her to death and was given a life sentence.
Was he blind at the time?
No. Blindness came later. He lost his sight in prison after an illness. He was paroled after serving 8 years of his sentence.
Anything more?
Well, our records show several arrests for minor offenses, but not here in Los Angeles.
Where?
In and around Chicago.
Chicago?
Yes, that's his hometown.
This is beginning to make more sense every minute. Thanks, Captain. Thanks very much.
Not at all, Inspector. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Herman, Waterbury.
I'm coming, Inspector.
Waterbury back yet?
He just got in. Here he is now. Hey, Waterbury.
I checked the victim's address, Inspector. Talk to the landlady.
Uncover anything?
Merely a confirmation of what we already knew or figured out. And a confirmation of the fact that the killer and his victim were married, though not very happily.
Yeah, that all fits in the story. Well, Herman, how about that telegram?
The Western Union has checked back. They say the telegram was sent from Chicago.
Chicago? That's all we need, gentlemen. All we need.
What's Chicago got to do with it, Inspector?
Everything, Waterbury. I just had a phone call from the Los Angeles police. They believe our man is one John Stevenson who was convicted of murder years ago, sentenced to life imprisonment, and then was paroled after he lost his sight in prison.
That's our man, Inspector.
The important information they gave me is that his hometown is Chicago.
And the bakery service truck driver said he dropped the man at a bus terminal.
You're ahead of me, Herman. My conclusion is that this killer will head for Chicago by bus, and is very probably on his way there right now.
Then we've got to work fast.
Right, we haven't a minute to lose. I want you two men to charter a special airplane. Fly to Chicago at once.
And cover all bus terminals.
Exactly. In the meantime, I'll phone the Chicago police a description of Stevenson and ask for their cooperation in covering the bus terminals. I'll give them instructions to pick him up on site.
Well, that shouldn't be too difficult. There are probably not too many terminals with buses arriving from Des Moines.
If you two men get going, you'll be there before John Stevenson arrives. So let's have some fast action.
The bus company said this was the most likely terminal for a bus from Des Moines, Waterbury. There's one due right now.
Of course, he might have stopped over somewhere.
Or he might have headed in the opposite direction. All we can do is sit tight and wait.
Here's the bus now.
That should be the Des Moines bus.
Well, let's see what gets out of it.
I beg your pardon, sir. I beg your pardon.
Waterbury, look.
Middle-aged man, dark hair, dark glasses.
And with an overnight bag.
And a cane.
That man is fine.
Porter, where are you?
Yes, sir, right here, sir.
Get me a taxi, Porter.
Yes, sir, right away.
Let's go, Herman.
Right.
And Porter.
Yes, sir.
Take care of this bag.
We'll take care of the bag.
And we'll take care of you.
Who are you? I can't see.
Police officers from Des Moines. Just walk with us.
You won't need a porter, Stevenson.
You can take that gun away from my back, officer. I won't offer any resistance. Where are you taking me?
You're going right back to Des Moines.
To police headquarters, where you're gonna talk.
Talk? About what?
You can think that over on the way back to Des Moines.
Later, at Des Moines Police Headquarters, John Stevenson sits at the desk of Inspector Curran and talks. Talks while the three police officers listen.
And so, after I became blind in prison, I was paroled. Some friends contributed some money, and I had a little of my own. And I decided to start life anew. That's all, gentlemen. I don't know anything about this murder charge you're talking about.
We think differently. And the evidence speaks for itself.
We found a white bone-handled knife in your suitcase.
And the clothes you wore away from the hotel, working clothes, spattered with paint.
And the powder on your neck doesn't quite cover up the marks where she scratched you.
Laboratory tests of the scrapings of skin found under the dead woman's fingernails compare exactly with your skin.
And your hair isn't dark, as you'd like us to believe. Without the eyebrow pencil coloring, it's gray.
Why the disguise? Were you running away from the crime?
Yes, I was running away. I didn't know.
Didn't know what?
I didn't know what I'd done.
Now listen to me, Stevenson. You must realize that we've got enough evidence to clinch a murder indictment. You'd better get the whole thing off your chest. You'll feel better.
Yes, maybe I will. All right, here's the story. I met Lily in Chicago. She was a hostess in a restaurant. I became very fond of her, infatuated. I began to be afraid that I'd lose her, so I asked her to marry me, and she agreed.
You were married?
Yes, in Chicago. And then I realized that she didn't love me, that she'd married me for my money, what little I had. We quarreled, and she left me, came here to Des Moines.
She worked here?
Yes.
I was very unhappy. I wanted to be with Lily. That's why I wired her, asking her to meet me here on Saturday.
But she didn't meet you?
No. I registered at the hotel with a friend of mine. Then he left, and I waited for Lily. Finally, she came. We got to the hotel about midnight and came up to the room.
And you quarreled? Again?
No. She said she was sorry that she left me, and she told me she decided to be a good wife and would stay with me. She left her boarding house checked out, so we retired.
Go on, Stevenson. What next?
Next thing I remember, I awoke suddenly. I could hear Lily going through my pockets. She was going to rob me and leave me again. Something happened to me. I lost my head, I guess. I pulled out my knife and slashed at her. I slashed wildly all around the room. I found her several times, and then she'd go away from me. Then I'd find her and slash again. I don't remember what happened after that.
You know now. You killed her.
I wasn't sure. I have nothing more to say.
No need to say any more, Stevenson. As far as we're concerned, your case is finished. From now on, your fate is in the hands of the courts of justice.
John Stevenson had nothing more to say other than to plead guilty to a charge of murder in the first degree. And so it happened. For the second time in his life, he heard a judge sentence him to life imprisonment. He is now serving that sentence. Justice has triumphed. Next week at the same time, the Mutual Broadcasting System will present another dramatization of an actual criminal case history taken from the files of the True Justice series appearing each week in the New York Sunday News and its syndicate. It is a case in which no two stories of the crime agreed with each other or with the facts. A case in which conflicting clues made a solution seem impossible. It's the case of the strange death of Mary Taverner. The dramatization you have just heard was based on an actual criminal case history. However, all names, characters, places, and dates were fictitious. These programs are produced and directed by Jock McGregor. They're written by Bryce Disk, Jr. The narrator was Carl Caruso. Inspector Curran was played by Barry Thompson, John Stevenson by Philip Clark, and the landlady by Helene Dumas. Others in the cast were Ken Dania, Paul Nugent, Ralph Locke, and Humphrey Davis. The orchestra conducted by Emerson Buckley played music written by Richard DuPage. Do you know that 31 million acres of timberland are destroyed by fire every year? That's an area larger than the state of New York. And do you know that 90% of these fires are started through the carelessness of just plain everyday people like you and me? 200,000 forest fires are started every year because we just aren't careful when they're in the woods. And timber is so vitally important right now to us as a nation. The Labor Day weekend is just ahead of us. Many of us will be going outdoors for picnics, hikes, or other outings. Won't you help cut down this terrific loss of the lumber that's so badly needed by every one of us? Just observe these simple rules. 1. Crush out cigarette, cigar, or pipe ashes. 2. Break matches in two before throwing away. 3. Drown all campfires, then stir them and drown them again. 4. Find out the law wherever you are before building fires. America needs its timber as never before. Help take care of it. Frank McCarthy speaking. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.